You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
It's enlightening. I don't know why people. I understand. I guess I can understand the sort of monetary motivations, but it's disappointing to see, you know, that people just don't want to get the truth out there about.
And
this.
You should have seen. And the hate mail we've gotten from this is astounding.
Really?
I mean, oh God! I mean, ethnic slurs and insults, and you know, one guy's writing, you know, you're the Tin Hatters, and I mean. The people we interviewed for this book, again and again, I mean, I'm sure Eddie Fisher is not the greatest source of reliable information, but the guy was addicted. He was a Jacobson patient for years. Even his family remembers that he was taking these drugs. He told us some unbelievable stories about Jacobson and the drugs. And I mean, it was Eddie Fisher, I forget who else, brought Jack Kennedy to a private meeting with Angie Dickinson, Eddie Fisher told us.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it was really, you know, strange stuff. So you've got all of that. You've got this inspiration taking place at Grossinger's in the 1940s. That was the basis of a motion picture, by the way. Very famous motion picture, cult picture with Tony Curtis. Tony Curtis talking about methamphetamines, and he was a patient of Max Jacobson. In fact, he was a patient. Marilyn was a patient. They both were having an affair on the set of Some Like It Hot.
Wild. So I guess just share with us the debate story, because we got off the track there. And
The debate story is this, that Kennedy was now a patient at this point. Rolling into the fall campaign, Kennedy was now a patient. And right before the debates, he goes to Max Jacobson. Now, remember, it takes you more and more meth to achieve the emotional level you want to achieve, right? That's one of the problems of meth. That's why the dosage of this stuff is so vital. So Kennedy lost his voice before the first debate, completely lost his voice, and he's sick. And Nixon is sick too. Remember, he had this leg infection. Nixon at one point had phlebitis, but this was years later. But he has this terrible leg infection. He smashed his leg open. These two guys are now sick, right? Nixon is ahead in the polls. It looks like he will win this election as of October 1960. Kennedy goes to Jacobson, and he can't talk, can't walk, can't talk. Jacobson says, I'll fix you up. That was his standard line. I'll fix you up. He gives Kennedy, right before the debate, an injection directly into his voice box. Kennedy becomes mentally alert. His voice returns. He's a man on fire. He goes into that debate. He tricks Richard Nixon into not putting makeup on. Then Kennedy does put makeup on. Beats the crap out of Nixon in the debate. Folks can watch it on YouTube. It's all there. Nixon is falling apart on stage. He's sweating. He's decomposing. He's tired. He's got a 5 o'clock shadow because the makeup didn't cover it up. The polls that night shift from slightly favoring Nixon to favoring Kennedy, and Kennedy never lost the polling edge at all, and won the election with the Cook County vote.
All thanks to the little
Max
boost
Jacobson.
From Dr.
Yep.
Max Jacobson.
There you go. How methamphetamine changed the course of an election.
Absolutely wild. It makes you kind of scared in a way because, you know, you know that the media is really pervasive now, but you almost wonder, too, like, what's going on under the surface nowadays that we don't know about, you know? It's kind of scary.
That's right. I mean, you have no idea what's going on. I mean, and this is just, I mean, that's why for all the, oh, it's 50 years ago, oh, it's this, you're seeing this now play out. Just technology has brought us new ways to run a secret government. It's just that simple.
Right.
I mean, you know, so the NSA, I mean, we all knew the NSA was surveilling phone calls. We knew this back in the 1950s. You know, we didn't need this guy, what's-his-face, Snowden, to tell us that. He popularized it for us, and the media went wild with the story. But I will bet you that everybody in the media that's publicizing the story privately knew all this was going on. I mean, the first episode of UFO Hunters that was never aired, by the way, never saw the light of day. It was shut down hard by the powers that be. And I mean, if you want to know about censorship, we go to Las Vegas. Remember 2006-ish, 2007-ish, there was this guy called Colonel X.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah, vaguely,
yeah. He gets Stephen Greer all whipped up about a UFO hovering over Las Vegas. Remember that story?
Yeah.
That was
yeah.
a cover of UFO Magazine. Nancy did it as a cover.
Okay, yeah, I remember that, yeah.
Okay, so this
mind.
Guy says, you got to bring your crew out here to film this. You got to bring folks out here. So I managed to get the production company to go to Vegas as the first episode. We go there. Okay? Go to Jim Sanders. Remember Jim Sanders? The Flight 800, TDW Flight 800, Soldiers of Misfortune, Memory Left Behind. Again, another cult writer. Go to Sanders' house. We see this object in the sky. I mean, I got to tell you, it was unbelievable. Brighter than the moon, hovering there, not moving, right above Vegas.
Yeah.
What the hell is that thing? So we go up, because there's light diffusion. I mean, Vegas, talk about light pollution. So we go all the way up into the National Forest outside of the city, get up to this restaurant, one of these plateaus, set up this telescope mated to a computer that's mapping the night sky. So we don't want it to be the International Space Station. We don't want it to be a Soviet satellite. We don't want it to be one of our satellites. We just want to know that nothing else should be in that portion of the sky except what we're seeing.
Right.
Sure enough, we confirm that, right? We get a photo of this sliver-like object, really a good set of photos of this sliver-like object on the huge camera telescope. Save it to the computer that we had. I walk inside this like lodge, and I'm texting Nancy back in L.A., we got it. We confirmed it. I hit the send button on my BlackBerry.
Oh, and it disappears. I remember this.
I walk outside. The thing disappears.
Yeah.
Disappears out of sight. And Bill Scott, Aviation Week Bill Scott, tells it, and it's down, right? Sanders, go back to Sanders' house. He says, oh, damnedest thing, Bill. Thing just disappeared. We leave Sanders' house. I get a cell phone call. It's back up. Ask Bill Scott. Bill Scott says, are they funning with you? They know you saw them.
Right.
They could see you. They scrubbed your text. They knew exactly what you were doing. You guys leave Sanders' house, the thing goes back up again. They could read your license plate from that platform. It's an NSA surveillance platform scrubbing data. Hello?
Yeah.
I didn't need this guy Snowden to tell me what the NSA was doing.
Right, that's the surprising part about, I think you and I are in agreement there. When I saw the news break, it was like, well, obviously they're, I never trusted whatever you write on, whatever you do on the internet. I figured it was already filtered through.
That's right, like, that's right.
Anyone
and then,
doesn't
you
think
know,
that is a fool.
If you write an email, I'll put it in these terms. If you put anything in writing as an email, a federal judge will see that email. Okay?
Yeah.
Bottom line.
It's amazing that people, the naivety of it all is, you know.
Right, exactly. I mean, why is it so like, I mean, just the Boston Marathon bombing. I mean, this should have blown people's mind. Yes, you want to catch the bad guys. Yes, they're terrorists. Yes, yes, yes. After you get through with all the yeses, right? All the yeses. Isn't anybody asking, gee, how come within hours they knew who did it? How come they had all these photographs, all these videos, all these this, all these that? We might as well live in the Truman Show, okay?
Right.
So if you're crying about the NSA and the CIA and what this idiot Snowden's talking, if you're crying about that, this has been going on for 20 years.
Exactly, yeah. And it's just, and because it's the, because they, it's like how they you always kind of presume the FBI was listening to phone calls all the time because they were, and it's like now that they have expanded the net to be able, no pun intended, the you know the proverbial fishing net to pull in even more information via the internet.
Absolutely,
so it's no surprise.
I mean basically what this is the And then the same people who are complaining, ooh, the FBI is listening to me, go on Facebook with stuff or Twitter with their most intimate secrets.
Yeah.
Which reveals their location, who they are, where they are, here's my picture, here's what I think, here's what I'm doing, here's a this, here's a that. And they're doing that with the idea that somehow these are private.
It's yeah, I don't understand, yeah. It's like I said, it's naivety, I don't understand.
People are idiots.
Yeah.
I mean, if you want to be private, for God's sakes, be private. Don't go on Facebook and then complain your privacy is being invaded.
Exactly, exactly. So let's wrap up the Jacobson story, and then we'll talk a little bit about sort of the current, we're in sort of the current state of affairs, but I want to get into some UFO talk with you, too.
Okay.
How did it all come crashing down for him? Obviously, I know, because I read the book, but sort of bring it home for folks here.
Okay, this is a great story.
Kind of
this is a great story. Focus back now on the Watergate story is breaking, right? The New York Times looks at the Watergate. First of all, this thought that, oh, Woodward and Bernstein, their brother. The New York Times walked away from this story, okay?
Mm-hmm.
They walked away from the story. They supported Nixon, by the way, in 1970. They walk away from the story, right? I can go into why there was a Watergate, but I'm not. But, I mean, you know, we don't have any time for that. But, so they walk away from the story, leaving it to the Washington Post. Which is why, by the way, in light of current events, there was a Pentagon Papers story, by the way. Okay, so they walk away from it. The Washington Post is left all alone now, and they develop the story. Meanwhile, they get a clue, a tip, that Vice President Spiro Agnew is visiting this medical office in New York, the strange doctor. So what they do... And this is Jane Brody, Rensenberger, Larry Altman. They surveil the office. They know they got a story here. They surveil the office, right? And they're seeing all these important people going in and out of the office. What the hell is Tennessee Williams? Look at all these people, right? Going in and out of the office.
Right.
So what they do is they pay a visit to this doctor. Jacobson thinks, my day in the sun has finally come. I'm now going to get the recognition I so richly deserve. Remember, he's high on meth.
Yeah.
I'm going to get the recognition I believe. I've been in the shadows for so long. I've helped the presidents. I treated Kennedy. I treated Harry Truman. Then Nixon wanted me. Agnew wants me. Now I'm treating these people. Finally, I will get my recognition. That scene of the Ten Commandments? Oh, pin that on me, because I'm the guy that gave Charlton Heston his injection.
Right,
okay.
Right. He's had his fingerprints all over a whole bunch of historic moments in cinema and politics. So
right.
He's
now,
right. There
are these reporters in his office, and they're appalled at the condition of this office. This is a
Yeah. Doctor's
office? They're a pigsty. So Jacobson begins bragging about what he did, how he treated Kennedy, how he treated Truman, how they, so Winston Churchill he treated... He's bragging about this. They're going, who the hell is this guy? So they steal some of the vials of his medicine. They find out that it's almost pure meth. Now they go back to him. Jacobson, believing he's going to be treated as a hero in the media, doesn't realize they're out to expose him. They begin to expose Jacobson. Right, this is the story.
Mm-hmm.
The New York State Attorney General, Louis Lefkowitz, pops up and says to them, kill the story. This is Richard Nixon. Remember, Lefkowitz is a Republican. Richard Nixon, Spiro Agnew, kill it. So the Times begins to back away. The Watergate story breaks open. All the president's men. The Times says, to hell with this.
Right.
They break the story. Now Geraldo gets the scent. Geraldo begins breaking the story. Don Imus gets the scent. He's breaking the story. This is now exposing Jacobson. New York State raids Jacobson's office. That's when they see the conditions. They say, this is crazy. This is insane. So they open up medical license revocation hearings on Jacobson. Does he deserve to keep his medical license? Who pops up? Jackie Kennedy. Jackie says to Max Jacobson, if you keep quiet about treating me, I will pay for your legal defense. Who does she bring in? Louis Neiser, the famous, my life in court, the famous Louis Neiser, who's one of Jacobson's parents. But Neiser gets one of his lawyers from his law firm, this guy Simon, this guy Rose, who defends Jacobson. Jacobson is going to be up on criminal charges. Louis Neiser's law firm gets him off the criminal charges, but they can't do a thing about the medical revocation hearing. So in the early 70s, Jacobson is now losing his medical license. Well, Richard Nixon, I mean, this is a nationwide scandal. Nixon sees this and says this is a dangerous drug. So Jacobson becomes the poster boy for Nixon's war on drugs. So from obscurity and a position of enormous power, wielding a drug, Jacobson becomes a tool of the New York Times, who needs something, who needs good scandal stuff to beat off the Washington Post, right? That's one thing. So he becomes a tool of the Times, a tool of these radio commentators, who also want a great story, a tool for Richard Nixon, who needs a raison d'etre for the war on drugs, and of course, methamphetamine becomes illegal. And Jacobson loses his license, goes to court to get it back. The court dismisses his case. He dies in poverty in 75.
Ugh. It's an amazing story. And, you know, we didn't even really get into sort of his early life. It's a crazy story of like rags to not necessarily, I mean, was it riches? Did he really get super wealthy off this?
Well,
or was it really he got off on the power of it all?
Jacob, well, he got off on the power, I mean, basically. But Jacobson bragged that he never took a dime for all of his work, but yet he had a research laboratory out on the edge of Long Island. Still exists, by the way. And he incorporated it in New York State. And we believe that that research facility, it was really a drug-pushing facility, sending drugs all over the world, because the amount of drugs that passed through that laboratory was unbelievable. The guy was a one-man drug ring. And then somebody who worked for him, remember the actress Alice Ghostly? She was on what? She was on Bewitched and a few other shows. Her husband was an actor called Felix Orlandi. Felix Orlandi worked for Max Jacobson, and he told us that Max was pushing drugs all over the place. Plus, remember, he was treating Sam Giancana, and Sam Giancana was very enthusiastic about this drug. In fact, Max was introduced to Sam Giancana in Las Vegas by Eddie Fisher. Giancana had a migraine or a severe headache. So he's sitting with Eddie Fisher, I forget which casino they were at, which casino hotel, and Eddie Fisher says to Giancana, this doctor can fix you up. So Giancana looks at Max and says, what do you mean? Max says, I can fix you up with one injection. And typical Momo Giancana, right, says, you better. Right? He does. Giancana's cured. So Giancana's a patient. Judy Exner-Campbell's a patient. Peter Lawford's a patient. Sammy Davis Jr.'s a patient. Dean Martin's a patient. Frank Sinatra's a patient.
Crazy. And I guess it's in typical sort of a drug story. When things go wrong, no one, you know, they just kind of let them twist in the wind. They're all set. So
right, exactly.
It's a strange and compelling story. And folks can get Dr. Feelgood at bookstores all over the place, right?
Go to Amazon, go to B&A, go to Barnes & Noble, go to the publisher's website, Skyhorse Publishing. Go to your favorite bookstore, buy the hard copy. Look through it and just look at the pictures. The pictures alone are worth. I mean, here's a picture in the book of Max Jacobson with John F. Kennedy. There's your proof.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. It's compelling stuff, folks. Like I said, go pick up the book. It's a great sort of it's a great summertime read. And for the folks who listen to this show, it's the kind of book you can read. And if you got the friends who are sort of like, oh, you're into that weird UFO stuff, this is kind of like a good toe in the water kind of book you can give to them and be like, no, the world's a lot stranger than you think. Here, read this book and, you know, come back to me and then maybe I can, you know, inform you about some of the other strange things that are happening in the world.
Right. And that's why when you look at the quote unquote straight news shows, right, howling about conspiracy nuts And then they start talking about this conspiracy that's been like a 50, 40-year conspiracy from the NSA about tracking communications. I mean, you know, we have to say, are you guys psychotic? Are you living in a schizophrenic world, totally split off from reality? Is that what you're doing? I mean, that conspiracy is okay. This conspiracy is not.
Yeah. Crazy.
It is. I mean, that's what bothers me. It's the hypocrisy of this.
Yeah, yeah. But if anything, it's your, you know, I guess we're moving into, like, just general discussion now. And if anything, that's sort of par for the course. You know, having seen and heard as much as I've heard over the last 8 years, it's no surprise that the real story never really makes it onto the mainstream media.
No, it doesn't. And this is the whole thing, but there is a level of goings-on, whether it's UFOs, whether it's all kinds of conspiracies that are real. I mean, governments, you know, it's great to be, oh, it's like transparent and, you know, we should, you know, really throw the light on this stuff. Tell me a government that does that,
right?
I mean, just tell me a government that does that. You cannot, I mean, I'm not saying it's good. I'm just saying it's part of the practicality of, what are you going to go to Russia and say, tell us, you know, tell us everything you guys are doing around the world.
Right? Exactly.
Tell us how you murdered that ex-Soviet agent in England, how you poisoned them to death. You go to the Israelis. Really, what did Yasser Arafat die from? You know, did he have some sudden disease? I don't get it. I mean, governments have secret clandestine services. The clandestine services do stuff for them, right? Stuff that needs to be done. There's this great movie, a great Oliver Stone movie called Any Given Sunday. And in it, Al Pacino plays this football coach, Tony D'Amato.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the speeches Tony D'Amato gives, the character Tony D'Amato gives, is that football is like life. If you control the edges, you can control the happening of events. So his model is, if you control the inches on the line of scrimmage, you control the downs. Control the downs, you control the game.
Mm-hmm.
If you control the seconds on a clock, you control the game. So control the seconds, control the inches, you control the game. How do you apply that to real life? Well, flashback to 2000, to the year 2000, Bush v. Gore, okay? Here is where Karl Rove was able to affect a vote suppression mechanism in Florida that suppressed the vote of the African-American population, suppressed the, took people off voting rolls, felons couldn't vote, just enough to affect the Electoral College in Florida. So when the time came to count certain votes and the Supreme Court stepped in, it was literally the Oliver Stone movie being replayed in real life, and that's how you got George Bush.
Right. You just exercise the control in a tiny little way.
Exactly. Well, that's what governments do. This is not any stroke of genius on behalf of anybody. That's
yeah.
Exactly what governments do. If there's a guy who is the centerpiece of developing high-quality plutonium for nuclear weapons, you kill the guy. Now you got to find somebody else.
Right. Now, obviously, as I said when we started the conversation, you know, you're intimately connected with the UFO subject. Everyone sort of associates you with that through the magazine, UFO Magazine, and UFO Hunters. What's your take on the current state of the UFO field, and what are your thoughts on this citizens' hearing that happened in April that everyone was all in a lather about?
I know. I mean, I thought it was. You know, I'm always fascinated by things like that because. On one level, it was a repeat of the citizens' hearing that was in 2007 when all these pilots, Oscar Santamaria, Parviz Jafari, John Callahan, and others, Chuck Holt,
yeah.
Jim Peniston, they all appeared before the International Press Corps. Not that there was a lot of International Press Corps there.
Yeah, I remember
there.
That. I think it was,
but,
I forget the name of the author.
Leslie Kane.
Yeah, there you go, yeah.
So you know, it was great testimony. I got to ask, well, we filmed it for UFO Hunters. I actually got to ask a question. James Fox, his little tip of the hat, put me in that movie.
Okay.
I mean, he might as well, because I'm the guy who got him the money to finish the movie in the first place. The movie I Know What I Saw, we were doing the Phoenix Lights episode together for UFO Hunter, so we're in the car. And Fox is, he's wailing, oh, I have no money, oh, I need $20,000, oh, what am I going to do? So I call up Jeff Sagansky, who was the head of Sony, the head of CBS, call him up, because they know he's fascinated with UFOs. We had a few meetings with Sagansky. So I say, Jeff, you know, it's a great movie here. I'll bet you can make a deal for the rights of this movie. If you can help, you know, some P&A money for Fox to finish it. I plunk them together. Nobody says thank you, by the way. I plunk them together. He gives him the money, gets the movie to run on History Channel, and that was the movie I Know What I Saw, which, by the way, that was my title that I gave to Fox. We're sitting in London with these, I forget the names of the pilots that had seen the UFOs over the English Channel. Mm-hmm. And so we're sitting there, right? What's his face? Not Redfern, but Nick Pope is a witness of this.
Yeah.
So we're sitting there, right? And I said, call the movie. Everybody in your movie starts out with, don't tell me what I saw. I know what I saw. So call it, make that the name of the movie, right? That became the name of the movie. So the point is, that was 2007 when they had this conference. So flash forward to 2013, and this is kind of a replay of that, only the difference was you're doing this as a congressional, a quote-unquote congressional hearing, because you've got retired people from Congress, paid, by the way, $20,000 a piece,
right,
in Congress to assess the evidence that they're hearing. Well, it's the same evidence we've been hearing for, like, 20 years.
Right, exactly. It was the time you're going to try and prove it to former members of Congress.
Well, what are you going to prove it to? Mike Gravel? That's proof?
Yeah.
But it was an exercise in disclosure, and that's fine. And you know what? For the inventiveness and entrepreneurship of Steve Bassett, congratulations.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, I think we're kind of in agreement on that. I feel like it was a good effort. It was, you know, an interesting undertaking. But I'm not necessarily sure that it really will accomplish the desired end goal of the
right.
event.
There's nothing there that we don't know, right? I mean, there's no story that was told that we don't know, okay? So in terms of new information, we already know what happened. But for them to expose members of Congress, which is actually what Bassett is after, can we have even though James McDonald did have congressional hearings on this, right?
Exactly.
I mean, we know McDonald conducted hearings. That's why McDonald was such a threat. That's why he had to be killed, and he was. Commit suicide, but he was suicided, let's just say. I mean, he did congressional hearings, right? So, great. We'd love to see this go to Congress, but it won't.
Yeah. I'm skeptical of that. And I think I was on another program as a guest, and I kind of made the point that I think we need to move away from the National Press Club. I feel like that's just that whole avenue's been done to death.
That's right, and this
like the
idea
that they've done there now.
You're right, and this idea that somehow you need a Barack Obama to stand up and say UFOs are real. That's wonderful. That's great. I mean, he's revealing a whole lot. We have a drone war going on in the Middle East. We have a president who's basically got a kill list, who runs this by unelected officials to determine who lives, who dies, right? There's a secret court of the Star Chamber, the FISA court, the FISA court. It's like a court of the Star Chamber. That person, you know, those rights can be trampled. I mean, I get it. I understand the war we're fighting. I understand all of it. But the idea that somehow that person is going to reveal that UFOs are true subjects, and why would you need Obama to do that when Harry Truman already did it 60 years ago?
Right.
1952, Harry Truman says, oh, well, these are UFOs. We all know what that is. Excuse me, there's your disclosure.
Right. It goes back to kind of what I've been saying. It's less a political problem, and it's more of a public relations issue.
Right. And you don't need Barack Obama to reveal it when Ronald Reagan did. You know, what did Ronald Reagan say? He's governor of California. He's flying back to Sacramento. He sees a UFO out over the desert. So he directs his pilot to follow the UFO over the Mojave Desert. The UFO disappears. So Reagan lands in Sacramento and says to the bureau chief of the Wall Street Journal, We saw a UFO over the Mojave Desert. I'm going to tell Nancy. I mean, that literally is what he says.
Yeah.
But we forget about that. Then Reagan is driving down Pacific Coast Highway, down PCH, for a party, for a birthday party for Bill Holden. Remember Bill Holden in the movie Network? Okay, mm-hmm. Fine. So Horse Soldiers, Bill Holden played the doctor.
Yeah.
So he's driving down to a party at Bill Holden's, right? And who's hosting the party? Lucille Ball. So he tells the story that he and Nancy see a UFO over PCH that goes out into the Pacific Ocean. He tells it to the assembled crowd. You don't see this turning up in the Wall Street Journal. You don't see this turning up in the New York Times. Oh, Ronald Reagan saw a UFO. Har, har, hardy, har, har. Yet, people are bending over backwards to extol what a great prophet Ronald Reagan was. The guy did UFO disclosure.
Right, right. So like I said, I mean, it has to be... We have to get sort of a – we have to change the narrative in a way.
Right.
We can't be like, listen, we need you to tell us the truth. We need to be like, all right, the truth is pretty obvious. What are we going to do about it? You know?
Exactly.
You know, so
– exactly.
I've advocated for just better public relations and even – and to try and entice academia into taking a second look at this. You know, if you could bring a fresh perspective to it instead of going to – science and being like, we know these are aliens. If you say, we don't know what these are, maybe you get a better response from some sympathetic.
I totally agree with you. I mean, this is, I mean, when you realize that, I mean, that's why what Kevin Randall and Tom Carey and Don Schmidt, I think Stan's involved in this, Stan Friedman, are all doing it makes sense. Kevin told me, he said on the radio, Kevin told me that he calls it the dream team, that what they're doing is they're starting from scratch to go over every piece of evidence they can regarding Roswell. Why Roswell? Okay? People would say, oh, Roswell, we're Roswell to death. I'm Roswelled out. Roswell this. Well, let's just say that you draw an analogy. Okay? Here's my analogy. Right? Mm-hmm. For good or for ill, here's my analogy.
Okay.
UFOs are like serial killers. How are they like serial killers? Well, everybody knows they're there, but nobody wants to talk about them, and they're hiding in plain sight. So if you use that analogy, you say, well, how do you investigate a serial murder crime? How do you investigate those things? Do you go chasing after this perpetrator and hope you'll catch him someday? No, there's a process to this thing, and there are two ways to do this process. This is the Ted Bundy case. Step one is you go back to the earliest case where you believe this person was committing that crime. Because in that early case is a lot of evidence that a more sophisticated serial killer, like Bundy and at the apex of his crimes, can now cover up. Right?
Yeah.
So you go to the early case. Exactly what Detective Bob Keppel in Seattle and the whole Ted Bundy task force did. Read my book, Riverman, about this case. And in that case, they investigated it from dust mites on the floor of the apartment where this first murder took place. And they found out that it wasn't like Ted Bundy and the victim didn't know each other. They damn well knew each other. In fact, she, Linda Healy, was in Ted Bundy's independent study psych class, A. B, she was roommates with Ted Bundy's cousin, so Bundy knew the apartment she was living in. C, they found that at the supermarket, the local supermarket, that when she was cashing her check at the register, right behind her, because the checks are time-stamped,
yeah.
Right behind her, Ted Bundy was cashing his check. He was stalking her. Okay? So much for this magic invisible killer, right? Well, this is the same thing. Go back to the earliest cases, Foo Fighters, Roswell. Go back to those cases and then reanalyze that data because you will find your clues there. Other step in solving a serial murder case. And it's this. Again, it's how the Ted Bundy case was finally solved. Since nobody appears or disappears without a trace, doesn't happen. Since that's the case, if you analyze every single piece of data from a certain moment in time, you will get a clue just by the proliferation of whose name turns up. So that's what they did in Seattle in the 1980s, right? They analyzed all these cases of missing and murdered women, and sure enough, the one of the constants was there was this person called Ted. This person was driving a VW Beetle. This person was at all the places from which girls disappeared. They didn't know which Ted it was, but they knew there was a guy called Ted. And when they ran the name through the motor vehicle database, they had to jury-rig a computer for this, they found out that it was Ted Bundy on from his license that was in all these places. So even before they caught him in Salt Lake City, they knew there was a Ted Bundy that was a person of interest in this case, applied the same techniques to UFOs. And that's what Kevin Randall and Stan and Tom Carey and Don Schmidt are all doing. They're going back, they're reanalyzing all the data from Roswell. Why? Because that was the first case, and the first case in which, in the first hours of the event, there was no cover-up.
Right, exactly, because the further you get from that, it's the better the cover-up becomes. So you have to kind of...
Exactly. You have, it's in the newspaper, in the headlines. There it is. You've got Brazel, you've got all the other witnesses. It took them time to clamp the cover down.
And I think even if they... Even if they unlock that, I think we need, a multi-pronged sort of attack, in a sense. Because no one's going to take... Again, I go back to the public relations things. Even if they're like, listen, we solved this Roswell thing, we have the proof. It's like, we still need to get the media on board, We still have to get the mainstream on board. We still have to sort of convince the unconvincible. And I do think that's sort of a generational thing. The younger people are, the more open they are.
It is. I mean, it's a generational thing, the same way civil rights and or rights for gay, lesbian, and transgender people. I mean, this is all generational. But here's the other thing which is so fascinating to me, and it's this, that people butt their heads up against the media. Like, somehow the media is like this huge paywall that if they glom onto the truth, then it's the truth. My theory is that you really don't have to convince, first of all, as one self-described CIA non-official cover officer told me this flat out when we were filming the show. He said, if you knew how many people in the mainstream media, and I mean liberals and progressives and people you see in the evening news, those faces are working willy-nilly for the CIA, you wouldn't believe it. He didn't drop any names. He said, I could drop names on you. You would be astonished at the people we work with who are listening posts for us, who deal with us. And if you think that somehow you're going to get a UFO story in the mainstream media without howls of laughter, forget about it. They are bought and they are paid for.
Right. So the game's already
Over. The game's rigged.
Yeah. So that's the word I was looking for. Yeah. So it's a challenge. It really is quite the challenge. And you can see that it's. I feel like there's a fatigue on the field of UFO research in general from spinning its wheels all these years.
That's right. I mean, at a certain point, you just overheat, and that's really what's happening. So my attitude is dig deep, dig down, and just mine the data, because the data is there, and you don't need MSNBC or CNN or whatever. You don't need them to confirm what you're doing. You keep mining that data. You keep making your arguments. And you seep it out, because what you then have is you do have a bunch of alternative media. And just get the data out there.
Right. And I advocate also for Nate Silver, the guy who predicted the presidential election using statistics,
right,
and all that.
Right, the 538 blog.
Right.
Sure.
You take, you get your hands on MUFON's database, or you get your hands on Peter Davenport's database, and you synthesize all that in these statistical formulas and whatnot, and who knows, you may come up with something the revelatory that we hadn't really thought of yet.
The data is there, just like the data identified Ted Bundy all the way back 40 years ago. The data is there.
Yeah, it's just not being worked with in the correct way right now. It's too much,
right?
It's a light in the sky, and here's what this guy saw, and it's like, all right, well, what can we, no one seems to ask the question, right, what can we do with this now? You know, where can we take this information? What can we
And that's one of the big issues. I mean, when we did UFO Hunters, we needed kind of like a philosophy of approach. And so we use mine, which was, let's pretend this is a Sherlock Holmes case. How does Sherlock Holmes approach a case? Sherlock Holmes takes every obvious or conventional explanation, he runs it through a complete logical process, and if it doesn't stand up, he rejects it. And you keep on rejecting what doesn't stand up until you're left with what does stand up. No matter how crazy what stands up is, pursue that in your investigation, because that's probably the truth that'll lead you down the path. Same thing with UFOs. So it's what we tried to do. But even were you to come up with a UFO, a lot of people would say, so what? Who cares?
Well, that's the sticking point too of the UFO field. It's divided on its ultimate goal in a sense. There's the people that want to figure it out, and then there's the people that just want to be told the answer.
That's right. And remember, for most people, even though they want to say, "Oh, UFOs are real. Oh, wow, cool," everything else. For most people, the idea of a UFO presents an existential threat to their logic.
Right.
Not to their lives, but to their logic. My view of the world is challenged existentially by the existence of another form of intelligent life that's dealing with us. That's why you're going to get a basic rejection from them.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. There's a deep psychological issue at work there, where it's like
right.
the fear of the unknown and the fear of humans. That, you know, people, they're comfortable being at the top of the food chain. They don't need to be worried about... You know, there's already people who are, like, terrified of sharks and crazy stuff that's not going to really ever get you. And
right.
So we're talking about, you know, technologically advanced humanoids, you know, that can come here and are far more intelligent than sharks, then I can only imagine the fear that people
Worse. Technologically far advanced humanoids who might well have started life on planet Earth. So everything you thought about when you were growing up as a kid in Sunday school, throw it out, because this is a whole new theory. Reinterpret the Bible as kind of an existential, as how human beings came to planet Earth. Our DNA was manipulated, how we advanced, and how they're tinkering with us today. And if you don't think that's an existential threat to life on planet Earth, to the logic and the raison d'etre for being a human being, then you're still going to beat your head against a wall.
Exactly. Why do you think... I've talked about this with other people in the past. It'd be interesting to get your perspective on it. Why do you think, you know, it seems like every decade or so we have a few signature cases.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like, you know, in the last maybe 15 years, there's been a dearth of signature cases, with the exception of O'Hare and Stephenville.
Well, there's O'Hare, there's Stephenville. You're right about that. But, and we're covering this case in this particular issue of UFO Magazine, the one that's out now. It's online. And folks can get, it's free. So,
awesome.
Same price as everything else. Free magazine, go online, go get it. Nancy put it up, it's done. In there is this article by a guy called Foo Fighter, right? That's his handle.
Mm-hmm.
This guy was in New York. I remember the, what's his face, the Fulham story of, these people who were in contact with extraterrestrials predicted there would be a big UFO event in New York City a few years ago in October.
Oh, yeah.
And sure enough, on that day, right, and it was kind of dismissed by the media, I was always struck by the fact that there's supposedly these UFOs up in the sky, right, hovering over 8th Avenue and 23rd Street, and all the television cameras are pointing at the ground and pointing at people. Morons, point the cameras up. That's where the UFOs are. You think that was an accident? No, it wasn't. So he took photos of this, and he told his story, and that's in this issue of UFO Magazine, along with a fabulous article by Kevin Randall about the citizens' hearing we talked about.
Mm-hmm. So maybe it's not so much that there aren't really good cases anymore. Maybe it's that there's so many cases that it's hard to really find the ones that are actually the ones we should be looking at.
It's that we've created... It's not just the 24-hour news cycle. We've created this huge digital chamber around us with television, with radio, with the internet. We've created that, and that's bombarding us with news. What we don't have as discriminating consumers of information are the right kinds of filters to be able to prioritize the news we're getting. That's why certain kinds of news organizations can boost news. And so that's why this story of the NSA revelations is so big. Everybody suspected it, but now it's supposedly big, okay? The same thing could happen with UFOs, but the fact is this, like the IRS scandal, this, like one of the other scandals, will go away because people really are bombarded with news. Benghazi, right? It'll go away.
Right.
It's like everything else. So it's not so much that we don't have the news. It's that you're kind of like, how can I put it? It's like you have your window for siphoning news doesn't work. It's either, it's probably just too far open. So everything gets in. So you have no discriminators for the news. So as a result, you're told what to get exercised about.
Yeah, and you're in a constant state of, like, the now. So
right, exactly.
There's no analysis or anything like that.
No, so when somebody says it's time to deal with UFOs, and that person, you know, is a Brian Williams, let's say, right? Fine. Now you deal with UFOs, because Brian Williams says deal with UFOs.
Yeah, well, that would be a strange day if it ever comes, but...
Exactly, so...
I'm skeptical, having been in this so long. But,
right.
You know. It's not as simple as like a Bigfoot type thing where they're like, oh, there's another animal we don't know about. This is like, oh, no, the whole world's going to have to change now, and I don't know if the world can handle changing.
Right, and when you've got aliens as fictional creatures, UFOs in shoot-'em-up movies, and Yetis in television commercials for buffalo wing wheat thins, who's going to believe it?
That's right, yeah. Well, you raise an interesting point there, too, yeah, that it's like... I remember I've been in this about a decade, I've been sort of looking at all this, and I've been sort of a content provider, let's say, for about 8 or 9 years, and it's the remarkable sea change of all this has been pretty, you know, revelatory to see. It's certainly not, it's still shoved off to the side, but it's given a certain cachet now. But I also think that goes to what we've talked about already, where it's like, you know, there's like 500 channels. There's just a need for programming on all fronts.
Mm-hmm.
So the paranormal fits as much of a niche as cooking and all these other, forms of programming, in a sense.
So you're exactly right.
You know, a rising tide lifts all ships. So
mm-hmm.
UFOs and Bigfoot and all that stuff and ghosts, they've risen up. It's like nerd culture, you know? It's like comic books and all that.
But I'll tell you something from the front line of reality television, if you walk into, a lot of the reality channels, and I talk to them all the time, are UFO'd out.
Yeah.
Okay? I've got a great idea for a show on UFOs, a great idea for a show on extraterrestrial visitations, on abductions, on this, on that, you name it, and it's like, oh, we already know about this stuff. It's been on the air forever. And that's one of the things. So on the one hand, you're saying we really can't break through this surface tension of the media. And on the other hand, everybody knows about it.
Right, right. Because it's like you said, like the thing in April was a rehash of the thing in 2006. It's the same problem facing.
It's the same program. Stories. It was the same stories that we heard in 2000 and it was 2007. It was the same exact stories.
Right.
There was no difference. So, and then the thing with the humanoid creature that Stephen Greer, the Sirius movie and stuff like that, fine, I get it. It was a human being. I don't know, it was had human DNA, whatever it was. Who knows what it was? The thing is that when the time came to have the disclosure conference, when the time came to have the citizens hearing, you had people like Rachel Maddow, who's on television right now, pounding the table about this conspiracy, laughing at the tin hat conspirators.
Right, right. Yeah. Well, the media coverage was either that, was either mocking, or it was just a rehash of press releases of these people are in Washington, they're going to have this event, it's going to be about UFOs,
right.
With no judgment on it. either positive or negative, to the point where it's just a bland rehash of a press release.
Right, and then you've got people like the Bill Nyes of the world or whoever who pop up and just paint everything with this one brush. They're all crazy. Right, Nichols, Nye,
yeah,
favorites in the media, who basically, and these guys are like, and they're jokes, right? I mean, these guys are absolute jokes. When you drill them down to a case, they will throw back in your face the same old tired arguments, right? So you take photos like the Trent photos from McMinnville, right? That Bruce Maccabee analyzed and reanalyzed and analyzed again. And you look at the history of those photos, like the Rex Heflin photos a decade later. You look at the history of those things, and you find out there's really something to them. Even if you can't immediately believe that Paul Trent photographed a UFO, what the government did to debunk the photos tells you that something is there that they didn't want you to know, right? When we analyze the Rex Heflin photos, which is finally what James McDonald said he believed in, the Rex Heflin photos from 1965, when we analyze those photos, again, we did what the, Kevin Randall's dream team is doing. You go back to the very beginning and you reanalyze that case. So we then analyze the metrics of the United States government debunking of those photos. Remember, the government said that based on their analysis of the photos, and they gave all the parameters of that analysis, right? Based on that analysis, Rex Heflin, because the object he was seeing was the wrong size against the background, it was a hoax. So we used, I think it was the Navy, correct me if I'm wrong, but we used the Navy's own metrics, their own parameters for how they built that argument that the photo of this, I call it a flying hubcap, that this photo was a doctored photo, was hoaxed. We used it. Then we laid the Navy parameters on the actual digital image of the photo itself.
Yeah.
And as we faded from one to the other, we could see that what the Navy said was true, that was the hoax.
Huh.
That the numbers didn't match up. That for the Navy to have been right, it would have had to have been something else entirely on the screen. That it was that they were wrong and the Heflin photo was right. So, I mean, that's the kind of science that I love to see.
Right, exactly. We need more of that and less, less going to the National Press Club and saying, give us the answer, because then, you got to show your work. That's kind of
right. The answer is there is no answer. That's the answer.
Exactly. Exactly. Think about how much more seriously we'd be taken as a field if instead of saying, we want the answer, if we were like, hey, here's the answer. So
exactly,
we got to change the paradigm here on this.
Exactly. All you know is there are things that you can't explain, and you run up against this wall of unknowing.
Mm-hmm.
And to get around or through this wall of unknowing, what you've got to say over and over again is what you know about this event. So what we know about JAL 1628, for example, is that James Callahan had all the tapes and all the documentation and all the substantiation for what happened in that encounter between whatever the object was and that Japanese Airlines flight, right?
Mm-hmm.
Had the radar, had the information from Ellendorf, had the military perspective. Who walks into that presentation? The CIA. They not only take all the material out of Callahan's hands, but say this meeting never happened and walk out. That tells you a lot about how the government views that JAL 1628 case.
Absolutely, yeah.
Right? In the Ed Walters Bentwaters case, Bruce Maccabee makes this point. All you know is that after Ed Walters left the house in Gulf Breeze, they found a wooden model of a flying saucer up above the garage. Oh, that proves he was hoaxing it. Okay? Now you analyze that, right? After Ed Walters sells the house, this air conditioning guy turns up, this guy out of nowhere, no ID, just says, I'm from the air conditioning company. He says to the new owners, I'm here to check on your vents. Right?
Yeah.
He goes in the house. They don't know what he's doing. Walks out. Your vents are okay. A couple of days later, a reporter shows up. Again, no ID. Hi, I'm investigating. Did you know your guy who bought the house from said he saw a UFO at this house? Oh, let me just look. Can I look around the house? Oh, look what I found. I found a model of a UFO. Strange.
Yeah.
And Walter said he never built the model. The couple never saw the model until the reporter said it was there. Suddenly, there's a planted UFO. Why would somebody go to that length to do that? But that they're covering up something.
Exactly.
And I could run you through the Paul Trent photos and the Rex Heflin photos. It's the same thing.
Yeah, well, we're dealing with some interesting forces at work here, that's for sure.
Right. So, I mean, one thing that I would do, in fact, I'm doing it now, by the way, in the second, the book with the UFO Hunters, the UFO Hunters Book 1 comes out in September. It's the television tie-in to the first year of the series.
Okay.
The next book that I'm working on now is UFO Hunters Book 2, about the second. I'm going to try to get some episodes in the third season in there as well. But one of the things that I'm focusing on in this book, as opposed to the first book, it's not an OG, oh, wow, look what we found. It's I'm focusing on things the government does or things that are done to debunk it and how the things that are done to debunk these stories are more outrageous than the stories themselves.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. That sounds awesome. Well, you kind of jumped the gun here on me in a good way. It's I was heading towards the end here. What's next for you? You've got the UFO Hunter Book 1 coming out in September.
I've got next month, July,
mm-hmm.
I've got a book coming out called Wounded Minds. And Wounded Minds is a serious book about PTSD, mental health, and combat veterans in the military. And it's basically saying that what the Department of Defense and the Department of Veterans Affairs has done is, for all their talk about the problems of PTSD since World War I, but really in modern times since Vietnam, they've basically kind of missed the boat on this. They don't understand it. When you deploy soldiers, especially National Guard soldiers, 3 and 4 times to the Middle East, there's no end point. These wars go on forever because of that.
Yeah.
You have these people who are seeing so much, and what are they seeing? Are they seeing landing at Normandy Beach? Are they seeing landing at Anzio? No. What are they seeing? What they're seeing is driving along a road, and the road explodes. Going into a village that's supposed to be friendly, and there's the Afghan National Army, and they're killing you and your buddies. What they're seeing is having to put together the remains of troops at forward operating bases who've been blown apart by a truck that drives onto the base and explodes. They're seeing this over and over again. And it's the multiple hit theory of post-traumatic stress disorder. That reduces your resiliency, so now suddenly you're in a parking lot outside a Walmart, and there's noise and running around, and you panic. Why? Because those are the kinds of things you've seen in Afghanistan and Iraq over and over again. So that's that book. And then what the Army did, by the way, what the Army did is astounding. At Madigan Army Hospital, which is at Joint Base Fort Lewis McChord up in Tacoma, what they did was they had a rogue unit in the psychiatric department there,
yeah.
And they were taking legitimate psychiatric diagnoses of PTSD, and they were reversing the diagnoses so that soldiers coming in to try to get some kind of medical disability were told, get out in the streets, go to a homeless shelter, stay out of jail, don't take drugs, goodbye, get out. Thanks for your service, by the way.
Oh, Jesus.
That's what the Army was doing. And that was the subject or the object of a Senate hearing with Senator Patty Murray for up in the state of Washington, questioning this General Hirohoho, who was the Army Surgeon General, on why this was going on. Okay, that's that book. In September, UFO Hunters Book 1 comes out, and then later on in the year, Another book is coming out called The Hearts of Darkness. And that's a really ambitious book. Again, Hearts of Darkness is more true crime and psychology than anything else. Hearts of Darkness is saying that we are in the midst of a phenomenal epidemic. And we know this, but I'm laying out the reasons. We're in the midst of this phenomenal epidemic of suicides and mass murder. We are. You just have to go back from Charles Whitman in the Texas Tower in 1966, who, by the way, was suffering from a brain tumor that was altering his behavior, and he could not convince one doctor that he was sick until he finally committed those crimes, was shot by the police, they did an autopsy, and that's when they found he had a brain tumor. So what we're saying is that there is an epidemic of all kinds of mental illness that's afflicting these generations of children. It's fed by a whole bunch of things, the media, digital wargaming, things like that, violence. It's fed by a lot, but it's also the result of human evolution socially from a multi-generational family, say circa 1915, to, in some cases, a single-generation family, kids living on their own, kids going through serial foster homes circa 2013.
Right.
That type of evolution, with no attempt made to recognize it, is partly the turbulence you're seeing in that generation. That turbulence you're seeing, that's on the edges, is resulting in this kind of, I call it apocalyptic violence. That book is coming out toward the end of the year.
Awesome. So it sounds like you've got some good stuff cooking. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, yep.
Well, on that note, we're right up against the clock here, and you've given us an extra 20 minutes, and I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
I'm telling you, we could probably talk for another 2 hours, and I wouldn't even notice, but we both have
things to do.
Exactly. I can't thank you enough, Bill. The book, Dr. Feelgood, outstanding. It is just tremendous stuff and just totally compelling, and the perfect book kind of for the summertime, you know, folks kind of lounging around. Pick it up, read it, and you will be really captivated by it, folks. It is fantastic. And like I said, Bill, thank you once again for coming on the show, and hopefully we can do it again in the future.
Thanks, Tim. Looking forward to it.
That does it for the penultimate edition of BOA Audio Season 7. Big, big thanks to Bill Burns for coming on the show and giving us so much time. You can find out more from him at www.ufomag.com. You can tune in to the podcast, which he hosts with his wife, Nancy Burns, at futuretheater.com. And, of course, you definitely want to go out and get your hands on Dr. Feelgood, because we only scratched the surface on this amazing book, so be sure to check it out. Moving right along now, it's time for BOA Audio Listener Feedback, but as is the case when we have a huge delay between episodes, we are going to eschew listener feedback here this week. I will try to do a monstrous installment of listener feedback on the season finale, kind of break tradition a little bit since we've been skipping listener feedback quite a bit here at the end of the show as we get close to closing out the season. I do want to give you all a little update on what's going on here, because it's been a month since you've heard from me. It's kind of weird, and there's been delays just continuously here as we close out the season. In the grand scheme of things, I guess the best way to put it is I am just totally burned out. I've never experienced this kind of burnout with the program. It usually happens as we get close to the end of the season, but this season has just left me completely frazzled. I am just completely worn out. And then I've been just hit on all sides by a variety of developments, let's say, positive and negative. A lot more work from my various side gigs where I actually make money. So I've had to kind of put BOA on the back burner while I try and make a living. Some good developments in my personal life, which I may explore sometime down the line, but we'll just leave it at that here. But certainly something where, additionally, I'd had to put BOA on the back burner because I've had some exciting things going on in my life. And beyond that, also, my mom had reconstructive knee surgery 2 weeks ago, and that took a huge chunk of time out of my schedule as I've been helping her recover from that surgery. So it's just been an absolutely crazy summer so far. Some good stuff, some bad stuff, and I've just had to really kind of put BOA, as I keep saying, on the back burner while I tend to the B part of BOA, which is, of course, banal, and that's my life. So that's really what's been going on here. We're going to have the season finale coming at you sooner than later. It's not going to take a month. The downside on that is that it's going to be shorter than your average BOA episode. It's going to be about an hour and 15 minutes long interview, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that as we get going here, closing out the program. But I could search around and try and find the ideal guest to sort of lock in and complete a two-hour season finale, but at this point, I just really want to close the book on season 7. It's been going on a bit too long now, and I'm ready to start the pre-planning for season 8 and also get into this exciting new venture, which I'm about to tell you about. So that's the deal, I guess you'd say. I'm kind of rambling a lot here, but I think I've covered pretty much all the bases. You know, tremendously burned out, lots of side work that's keeping me busy, very positive developments in my personal life, and reconstructive knee surgery for mom. So that's the many issues that have been going on here at BOA HQ. Not to mention just an intense summer of heat and humidity and the kind of stuff that just makes you not want to even sit at the computer for more than 5 minutes. Do not fret, my friends. There's going to be a season 8. I've already got a whole bunch of guests lined up. I really want to get started on that. And I think really kind of my mind has just sort of mentally closed the book here on season 7 already, prematurely. And for that, I apologize. But another part of it is that maybe some folks have picked up over the years. As I go longer between episodes, I feel terrible. And I start to really stress myself out, which isn't good for me at all. And that's been going on a lot here at the end of the season as well. It's probably contributed quite a bit to the burnout. Because I keep trying to raise the bar here with this program. And I keep trying to deliver better and better episodes and more compelling conversations. And when I can't get them out to folks in a timely fashion, I just start to beat myself up over it. And I get very stressed. And it's just not good for me. So at the end of the day, we're going to push out the season finale, hopefully for you in the next 10 days or so. But the good news is that will not be the last you hear from me for an extended period of time. Traditionally, we roll out the season finale and then you don't hear from me for about 2-3 months as I reboot and revive myself. However, this time around, that is not going to be the case, because upon the release of the season finale of BOA Audio Season 7, I will have exciting news for you about a date that you'll need to look forward to, because that will be the premiere of Banal of America Audio Live. That's right, we're going to take the program in a little bit different direction, at the very least, during the interim period here between seasons. And we're going to start presenting some live programming for the BOA Audio listeners. I've been really wanting to do this for a very long time, since, you know, last fall, but haven't really had the chance to get around to do it. It's kind of hard to sort of balance the two programs at once. And really, like around the beginning of the summer, I've been looking forward to doing this live program for a while. I kind of made the decision at the beginning of the summer that once we concluded BOA Audio Season 7, I was going to start doing some live programming while I also put together Season 8. And truth be told, I started to get more and more excited about doing these live programs that my mind really was becoming more occupied with that. And that's really another reason why I want to hurry up and get Season 7 concluded, so we can really dig into the live format. I'm just really excited about the potential and the things we can do in a live setting with BOA Audio. So I don't want to tell you a premiere date just yet, but it's not going to be far from the season finale posting date. I'm talking maybe a week, 10 days at the most, and it's probably not going to be a weekly program. It may be every 10 days, it may be every 2 weeks, but it certainly won't be once a month. It's definitely going to be more frequent than the BOA audio episodes you've been hearing over the last 2 months. So that's kind of the big news. There's a lot going on here, folks. There's a lot going on. Don't stress out. BOA Audio is not going anywhere, my friends. I have got some awesome guests lined up, not just for Season 8, but also for the live program. I've got some awesome ideas for the live program that I'm just dying to really get going on. So the best thing I can tell you right now is stay tuned. We're going to have information posted at Banal of America as soon as we decide on the premiere date for BOA Audio Live. So check there. Additionally, stay tuned to Banal of America on Facebook. That is where I will have the announcement about the premiere date and time for BOA Audio Live. And of course, I should mention that even if you can't hear us on BOA Audio Live, the programs will be archived in the traditional manner at Banal of America and on our podcast feed. So you're not going to have to wait too long to hear the programs as they get rolling out. Speaking of the Banal of America page on Facebook, we have passed 1,000 likes. We've crossed the threshold, folks. We've not only passed it, we've taken quite a few little baby steps over it. We're now at 1,010 likes. So let me now officially congratulate and provide the shout out to our 1,000th like. His name is Rick Brandon. He probably has no idea that he was our 1,000th like, but he has achieved historic status here by becoming our 1,000th like. I'll also give a shout out to Bob Dion, who is our 999 like, Rachel Faulkner, our 998 like, Andrew May, missed it by a smidge, he was number 1,001, and Greg Fafard was number 1,002. So, congrats to those folks who liked us around the historic number 1,000. With all that said, let me give you the rundown on how to get in touch with me if you want to make guest suggestions for Season 8 or for the live program. I'm going to focus really at the very beginning on bringing back some BOA favorites to the live program. So folks you've already heard on the show who are BOA regulars will be a part of the initial episodes of BOA Live. Then we'll probably get cooking with some fresh new guests in the live format. Nonetheless, guest suggestions, here's how you can send them to me. You can write to boaaudio@hotmail.com. You can head on over to banalofamerica.com and click the contact button. Or you can join up at the official BOA forum, theusofe.com, theusofe.com. That's BOA's paranormal playground where we have discussions on the world of pop culture as well as esoterica. Fantastic group of folks there, always having fun conversations. Additionally, you can find me on Facebook and Twitter. Just punch in Banal, B-I-N-N-A-L-L. That'll bring up my profiles. Feel free to befriend me, follow me, or poke me. It's all good. And I'd be happy to have you as part of my online circle of friends. And just because you might have missed the 1,000th like at Banal of America on Facebook does not mean that you cannot like us nonetheless. So feel free to punch in Banal of America into the Facebook search page. That'll bring up the page. And if you haven't liked us yet, go for it, folks. It would be great to have you as part of the BOA community on Facebook. Now, let me take a moment here and thank the outstanding and esteemed BOA staff. Leslie, Chiron, Regan Lee, Joe V, Tina Senna, Richard Thomas, Marla Pena, Bruce Pretty, Tony Morrill, our webmaster, Ray Weigel, and our graphics guru, Jeremy Boston. It's not just BOA Audio that has grown static, folks. The development of BOA 2.0 has the development of BOA 3.0 has also grown rather static. That is entirely my fault. I have got to get back in touch with Ray Weigel. I feel like a total heel at the moment because he's waiting on me to make some final approvals on various aspects of BOA 3.0. So hopefully we can launch BOA 3.0 to coincide with either the season finale of BOA Audio Season 7 or the premiere of BOA Live. Stay tuned to Banal of America. We will have something cooking for you in the not too distant future. Now comes the time in the program where I take my hat off and pass it around to the BOA audio listeners and ask you to help out the Banal of America franchise. How do you do that? That's simple. You can make a donation via PayPal. There's a button right there at Banal of America. Or you can mail a snail mail donation to Tim Banal, P.O. Box 232, Pinehurst, Mass. 01866. And you can find the complete address at banalofamerica.com right under the PayPal button. As always, it bears repeating, my friends, no donation is too small, and all donations go towards Banal of America and BOA Audio to help keep the entire franchise up and running, freely available, and commercial-free for all of our great readers and listeners the world over. On the next edition of BOA Audio Season 7, as if you did not need me to tell you again, it is the season finale of BOA Audio Season 7, and in keeping with our tradition, our guest is a historic figure in the field of UFO research and paranormalia. We're going to be featuring a compelling conversation with legendary UFO abductee Travis Walton. This is a really fascinating conversation, folks, and one that really had me stretching in a lot of ways, because Travis Walton has done many interviews in the past, and I really want to go into this asking him questions that maybe, hopefully, he had never been asked before. I think that was definitely a mission accomplished in a lot of ways. I tried to probe the story from angles that maybe it hasn't been explored before yet, and we get into a whole bunch of stuff. We just really wring this story out and dig into it from a myriad of angles. I can't even begin to tell you all the different aspects of Travis's story, which we discussed during the program. I can tell you, I think I came into it with maybe 15 questions listed and probably closed the conversation having asked over 20, maybe 21, 22 questions. So we covered tons of stuff. And I think folks are really going to enjoy this one. It is a fascinating conversation and one that when I hung up the phone, I said to myself, there is the season finale. I felt like I really didn't need to do much more than that. I know it may be a bit disappointing to some folks. The episode's going to be less than your average length for a BOA audio episode. But having looked back on the history of the program, it's kind of frightening in a sense. The very first season, maybe the second season, third season, a lot of the episodes were just an hour long. Then they became 90 minutes long. Then they grew to 2 hours long. And now some of them are clocking in at 3 hours plus. And that, I think, contributes a lot to this burnout effect, which I've been talking about here on the program. I could have chased down a second guest to fill out the season finale, but I really didn't want to pad out the final episode of the season with a guest that I would not consider in keeping with the historic significance that we try to adhere to in the season finale. So, much like the very first season finale, which featured notorious UFO hacker Gary McKinnon, this season finale will also clock in probably at about 90 minutes all told with the various bells and whistles. Nonetheless, I think this is a fantastic conversation and certainly worthy of the season finale status here on BOA Audio. Legendary, historic UFO abductee Travis Walton comes to BOA Audio for an in-depth exploration of his abduction experience on the season finale of BOA Audio Season 7. And on that note, we close the book here on this edition of the program. Big, big thanks once again to Bill Burns. Folks, definitely go out and pick up Dr. Feelgood. It is fantastic. And, of course, enormous thanks to all you folks out there, the hardcore BOA audio listeners. I've been getting your emails. I've been getting your Facebook posts. I'm doing all right. Everything's fine. And the future looks brighter than ever, my friends. So stay tuned, because it is going to be a wild ride. Thank you once again for your enduring support of the program. And, of course, thank you for making BOA Audio a part of your esoteric audio playlist. Until next time, this is Tim Banal, thanking you for listening and signing off.